Good morning, everyone. I hope you are practicing your social distancing as this frustratingly beautiful day goes on outside there. I would love to be out and, well, you know, I do have my little garden out here that I can hide in and still be outdoors, but I hope everybody is staying away from each other. The question was asked, is the exam going to have a similar format as the quiz? Yes, but the exam, if it was scheduled for this Wednesday, it's not going to be Wednesday because we're not going to finish reviewing today. It's going to have to be Friday instead. It is going to be the same format. It'll be the same type of thing where you'll get 24 hours to do it. It is not going to be obscenely hard because it is take-home. You saw that the last time that the quiz wasn't all that hard, even though it was take-home. So, yes, it's going to be the same format. And in fact, what I wanted to do today is try to help make a little bit more sense of this chapter that we're working through, because I've been talking about bits and pieces of chapter 12 in an order of my own. Oh, and someone had just let me know this morning that Friday's notes somehow are not working, and I did not have the time between lab and lecture to take care of it yet, so I will be fixing it when I post these notes later on this afternoon. But like I said, I want to go through chapter 12, and I want to do it in the order of the book. And so the first thing we start out with in section 1 is about the three different phases of matter. Now, because we've already talked about those, I'm not going to write anything new. I'm just going to address the different sections one by one. And the book does start out with the same kind of discussion of condensed phases. Do the molecules actually stick together? That would be what we have in a liquid or a solid. What happens at a macromolecular level, in other words, the human level, at a molecular level or the microscopic level? The changes in phase, we have not talked about that yet. So we have solid, liquid, and gas. Those are the three standard phases of matter. Someone was asking the other day, what about plasma? Well, plasma doesn't normally exist in everyday average conditions. It's something that you generally need really high temperatures for. And that's where electrons start getting ripped off of atoms just because of the temperature itself. So we won't ever be talking about plasmas in this class. We will talk, if we get a chance, about something called a liquid crystal, which is something that has behavior in between the solid and liquid phases. But I'm getting away from the three phases I'm supposed to be talking about. So, please either type it or shout it out if you know. What do we call the transition from a solid to a liquid? Melting. Although the book points out, and I don't know historically why it's called that way, but fusion is another term that's used for melting. So when we have heat of fusion, that means the heat that's necessary to melt something. And if we go the other direction?
Freezing.
Freezing. There we go. Okay, and then let's do the liquid to gas. What do we call when a liquid goes to a gas?
Evaporation
or vaporization. And then what do we call when we go the other direction?
Condensation.
All right, and let's see. Let me just put vaporization here instead of evaporation, because vaporization is kind of the more correct term. Vaporization. Okay, now the ones that people don't always know. And let me... I'm not doing good on board management today. There we go. So if we go from a solid directly to a gas, what is that called?
Subjection.
Sublimation, that's right. And then the last one, if I'm going from a gas back to a solid, that is?
Deposition.
Deposition, that's right. So there's our energies of phase changes. Now, if we go from a solid to a liquid, then we have this energy involved, which is the heat of fusion, F-U-S. And if we go from a liquid to a gas, then we already are familiar with this heat of vaporization because we've been talking about the heat of vaporization lab. Okay, so if we wanted to go from a solid to a gas, what is that going to be? In other words, what would the heat of sublimation be?
Heat of fusion plus heat of vaporization.
That is right. The heat of fusion plus the heat of vaporization. Of course, now having answered the question, you know the danger is the follow-up question, which is why? Oh, snap. Hess's Law. What does Hess's Law say? Energy changes in chemical transformations do not depend on how the transformation occurs, only on the initial reactants and the final products. I'll translate that into English in a second. Energy changes in chemical processes do not depend on how they occur, but instead only on the initial reactants and final products. Doesn't matter how you get there, where'd you start and where'd you end? That's the English. Doesn't matter how you get there, where do you start and where you end? Excuse me. Graphically, let me show you what Hess's Law is. And those of you who had me in a previous quarter have heard this, so you can go to autopilot for just a moment, but for everybody else that hadn't heard it yet, you know, suppose that none of this nonsense had happened. We were sitting there in De Anza. And let's say that the only way that you could have survived the morning class, those of you in section one, is if you get your coffee, wherever that might be, Starbucks or whatever your coffee company is. I'm a tea drinker myself, but. So, what is the proverbial shortest distance between those two points? A straight line. Which will never change until the earthquake hits and literally moves the earth between these two points. Now, that's different than the path you might take to get from one point to another, which might be unique to each one of you. So that part in green there, that's what is known as a state function. And to put it in short language, it only depends on the initial and final states. So not the total distance traveled, the actual distance between the points only depends on what the points are. So how does this have anything to do with Hess's Law? Hess's Law says that energy changes in chemical reactions are state functions. It means it doesn't matter how you made the reactants. It doesn't matter how you made the products. What is the energy you start with in the reactants? And what is the energy you end with in the products? And Hess's Law says it doesn't matter how you get there. It's going to be the same. That's why you can add together the heats of fusion and vaporization to get the heat of sublimation, because you start and end at the same points. And yes, I'm going to be writing this down. So first, let me state what I stote about Hess's law, which is this. Energy changes in chemical reactions Okay, so I guess I lied. I didn't translate into English. I translated into math. Because once you know what a state function is, you go, oh, okay. So now I'll translate into English, but first, take your screenshots. All right, and now let me write it down in English. The energy in reactants and products actually, let me make that an even better statement. The internal energy of the reactants and products does not depend at all on how they were made. Just on what they are. So, if any series of reactions starts and ends at the same point, the energy changes will be the same. And to get to the point, this is why the heat of sublimation can be calculated by adding together the heats of fusion and vaporization. And 20 minutes into lecture, we've made it a page or two into the book. That's okay. We needed to do that. So, questions? All right, so let's move on to section two then. So, section two gets more into the thermodynamics of phase changes, which I know we haven't talked about at all yet, and that's why the exam is going to be delayed, so we have the time to get through it properly. Suppose that we had ice. Excuse me. And let's get more specific. Let's say, that we had a 10.0 gram block of ice at, is it still updating the iPad?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So let's say we had 10 grams of ice at negative 5 degrees Celsius at 1 atmosphere pressure. Now, I know that last lecture we started talking about phase diagrams, and we're going to get back there. But remember, I'm trying to go through the book in order now. And let's say I wanted to know how much energy total was it going to take to turn it into steam at 105 degrees Celsius at 1 atmosphere pressure. So the question is, what is the total energy needed? And the answer is complicated. And let's draw a graph to understand why. And let's say, well, let's not say, I'm going to tell you what this graph is for. We're going to look at how much energy is necessary in order to reach the different temperatures that ice is going to go through. Because I'm saying we're going to start out here at negative 5 degrees Celsius. At 1 atmosphere pressure, the normal melting point of water is 0 degrees Celsius. At which point it will become water, and then that will heat up. At 1 atmosphere pressure, the boiling point of water will be 100 degrees. And that's the next thing we're going to talk about, boiling points. But then I said once we turn it into steam, we want to keep on going and reach 105 degrees Celsius. So these are like our goalposts in this heating up process. So let's say that we have a constant amount of energy added. And right now, I don't care about the units, just that it's increasing as we keep on going. So what's going to happen? Well, as we start out, in a perfect world, there'll be a linear relationship between temperature and the energy added. But once we hit 0 degrees Celsius, this graph is going to go flat for a while. Why? Because if the energy's added in a little bit of time, you can either change temperature or you can change phase, but you can't do both. So then once the ice melts, then the temperature can change again. Now, this graph is not to scale because it takes a lot of energy to heat up and even more energy to turn into steam. So this is just conceptual what's going on. Because then here, yes, once you reach the boiling point, all that energy then goes into evaporation, into vaporization. And then the energy can increase again. So you can chop this graph into five. Wow, let's see if the instructor can draw. Which is tougher on an iPad than I thought, but it works so well. There we go. So we got these five regions, and I'm going to label them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay? Now, anticipating the type of problem we're going to work. In section 1, there is a change in temperature going on. In section 3, there's a change in temperature going on. And in section 5, there's a change in temperature going on. But in the other regions, there is no change in temperature. We just have a phase change going on. There is solid to liquid going on here, liquid to gas going on here. So that means in section 1, the whole time, we're dealing with a solid. In section 3, we're dealing with a liquid. And section 5, we're dealing with a gas. All right. So liquid water can exist at 0 degrees Celsius at STP. Yes. Just not at equilibrium. Eventually, it will freeze. Now, we're going to get back to that discussion of phases in a bit. So if you can hold the follow-up thoughts you might be having on that, let me get through this diagram first. So what I'm going to do, in fact, is copy this so we can start the discussion on the next page with it, which is how do we come up with the equations for it? All right. So in sections 1, 3, and 5, we're going to use heat capacity because there's a change in temperature going on. In sections 2 and 4, all that's happening is a phase change. So no delta T. So let's write each equation out one by one. Can you go back to the last slide? There we go. All right. So, equation one. What is the equation for the energy change when we have a change in temperature? It's the mass of the substance times the specific heat of the substance times the change in temperature. But it's the specific heat of ice, which is not the same thing as the specific heat of water. Also, we're not talking about the -5 to 105 degrees change. We're only talking about the change in temperature that ice undergoes. So I'm going to put red lines here and big red stars that some of you, unfortunately, are going to miss when you work this problem, because it happens every year. But these values are different for each phase, solid, liquid, or gas. So we cannot come up with one equation that has just these simple variables. We have to tackle it for each phase. Is that true for all substances? I would guess yes. That's a guess. But the amount of intermolecular forces versus energy balance in order to make a liquid versus a gas, I'm presuming, is usually different than that between a solid and a liquid. So it's a guess, but probably a reasonable one. Now, section two. How do we measure energy during phase changes? Well, curiously, it's usually moles, not mass. And then it would be the heat of fusion. Wait, Dr. Gray, does that mean that like the problems are going to be a little bit evil because you have to worry about whether you're talking about grams or moles? All right, so mass for section three times the specific heat of water times the temperature change that only the water undergoes. And then in region four, that's back to a phase change. So that would be the moles times the heat of vaporization. And then lastly, we would have mass times the specific heat of steam times the temperature change that the steam undergoes. And just to make sure there's no confusion, here the temperature change that ice undergoes is plus 5. Here the temperature change that water undergoes is plus 100. And because I made it 105, okay, so this comes out to be matching number one, but only coincidentally. Can you just define the values below the formula? So S is specific heat. Which is sometimes called specific heat capacity. Delta T is probably obvious. That's the change in temperature. Heat effusion and vaporization, those are defined on previous pages. Then N is moles, and M is mass. And the total energy needed is equal to all these things added together. Why? Hess's law. Purple circles, that's the temperature change. Just trying to highlight that they're not all the same. It's coincidence that the first or the third happen to be the same because your instructor maybe should have chosen a different temperature up above. In fact, wait. I did say 107 degrees to begin with anyways, right? Because that's what's on the page here, right? And so that means actually this temperature change here is now different and would be plus 7, right? That's what I said all along, isn't it?
I think you say 105 at the beginning.
What? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you very clearly.
I think it's at 105.
Oh, you know, your voice is so beautiful, but I don't understand the words. I'm joking.
Oh, that's fine.
All right, take your pictures. Why is the specific heat for each phase different? Just because someone made the quote, "No, we do not eat our kitty." Why is the specific heat for each phase different? Because the amount of interactions between atoms and molecules changes as the phase changes, because solids are held more tightly, liquids generally less tightly, and of course, gases are not a condensed phase. Screenshots! I said screenshots, not jello shots. Okay, then that gets us to equilibrium in section 2, which we already talked about equilibrium. And finally, on page 479 of the text, you have the graph. You have that energy distribution diagram. You even have it at two different temperatures. And it shows the kinetic energy needed to overcome intermolecular forces. And that's the graph we've talked about over and over and over and over again. And then that gets into vapor pressure. And it even, I forgot, your text even has the Clausius-Clapeyron equation. I could swear that previous editions, or maybe it's a different text we used to use, didn't have it. What page is that again? Okay, so the version I'm using, which might be an instructor version, but the graph is on page 479.
Thank you.
And then vapor pressure comes right after that with the Clausius-Clapeyron equation. And then it makes this point about boiling point. So now I would like to talk about boiling point. Because boiling occurs when the vapor pressure...
Is it frozen?
Yes, it is. I guess it couldn't handle the phase changes. There we go. Boiling occurs when the vapor pressure of a substance equals the surrounding atmospheric pressure. This means that boiling point changes with pressure. So, again, to put it in a very crude graphic, Let's say that this is the ocean. And let's say that we have one atmosphere pressure pushing down right in the ocean. That means right here on the coast, the boiling point of water is going to be 100 degrees Celsius. Oh, great internet. What is the elevation of the Dead Sea? The Dead Sea is at a surface elevation of, oh, it would have to be in meters, wouldn't it? Well, let's not worry about the numbers. It's just way below the level of the average ocean level. So what is the boiling point at the Dead Sea? Turns out, it's 101 degrees Celsius. Why? Lower elevation. More atmosphere above. Okay. What about here in Denver? No, I mean I'm here in Denver. But what about in Denver? Oh, great internet. What is the boiling point of water in Denver? And the answer is 95 degrees Celsius. Why? Higher elevation. Elevation, yes. Elevation. Less atmosphere above. And a heck of a lot less oxygen, too. You know, I don't know if any of you have ever been to Denver or any other place that's high altitude. But first time you go, even just walking around, you might get a little lightheaded just because you are at an oxygen deprivation. And at the time, well, it still is, but my preferred form of aerobic exercise is swimming when I can. Not doing much of that right now. And I got my posterior kicked when I tried to swim up in Denver because, again, the oxygen difference. So just as a fact that the amount of atmosphere above has a profound effect on us and also just on physical properties of substances. So that's boiling point. And, yeah, so some of you, even you youngins have experienced this, I guess. So it's not just, and I'm not a boomer, by the way, I'm not old enough to be one, but I guess last quarter in one of my organic classes, because we made the transition online, they started calling me MVB, Most Valuable Boomer. I had words for them. Okay, so this finally gets us to phase diagrams, which is where we left off with class the other day. So I'm going to draw what I call a normal phase diagram. Okay, so instructors kind of try to remember to tell everyone when we're switching topics. So now we're talking about phase diagrams. And this is normal on the left and water on the right. Because if you've read the book, which... How many of you have read the book? That's what I thought. Okay. Wow! Yes, as someone said. Good grief. Here's normal substances. And, okay... I'm copying the book because I guess I wasn't drawing things totally correctly. So this, for example, is CO2. There we go. And I'll even do what the book does. And fill in here a little bit. Maybe I won't. That's too much. Okay. We'll just say S for solid. L for liquid. G for gas. Which that doesn't show up, does it? Let's try that again. G for gas. And C for cookie, which is good enough for me. Now, remember, what's this thing called here? The point where all these things meet? That's the triple point. And that is the temperature-pressure combination at which all three phases, exist, but not just exist, in equilibrium. And for carbon dioxide, that happens to be negative 57 degrees Celsius and 5.1 atmospheres. Okay, now realize that normal atmospheric pressure is just one atmosphere. So if I wanted to add a line onto this graph, I could say, well, what do we have here at one atmosphere? Well, at negative 57 degrees Celsius, it's going to be a gas. As we increase temperature, it's even more likely to be a gas. And so that means at normal atmospheric pressure, there is no liquid carbon dioxide. And so that's why if you've never heard of dry ice, that's just solid carbon dioxide. And at normal atmospheric pressure, which is where I've got circled here, and where am I going to write this? At one atmosphere pressure, carbon dioxide will go directly from solid to gas. That's one way we can use these phase diagrams to tell what's going to happen. We could also talk about what would happen at one particular temperature, which we'll do that once we do water here. Now, what does water's phase diagram look like? Again, I'm going to cheat and look at the text and try to replicate what I see there. And the main point is that the solid-liquid line has a negative slope. So again, let me point that out on the water diagram, that the solid-liquid line which that's the equilibrium line has a negative slope. And so I said a few moments ago that let's talk about what would happen to water if we followed along just one temperature. So here the triple point is 0.1 degrees Celsius, 0.01 degrees Celsius actually. So near the traditional zero freezing point of water. And then the pressure is very low, though. It's 0.006 atmospheres. So we hang out at one atmosphere, which, just to put that line on here, just like I did on the other diagram, let's put the one atmosphere in. Okay, but I said let's talk about one constant temperature. So let's say that we were at negative 5 degrees Celsius. We know where the triple point of water is. That's at pretty much 0 degrees Celsius. So if we start out where the bottom of the line is, we see that we have the gas phase first. That makes sense. That's what you have when you have very little pressure. And then we increase in pressure. Most substances form a liquid if they're going to form anything condensed. But water is backwards. It forms a solid first, and then when you keep on pressing on it, then it eventually turns into a liquid. If you just follow the purple line, it goes from gas to solid to liquid. So what's going on here? Liquid water is more dense than solid water. Why? Well, I could do this in a quick way, and then we'll start out the next lecture with me giving the more proper answer. So please go ahead and, please go ahead and get your screenshots. And no, it's not low levels of intermolecular forces. Water's behavior is caused by high levels of intermolecular forces. So let me flip pages here. And what I'm attempting to show is how a group of water molecules might all interact with each other. So here you see three water molecules that what if they have just the right distance between each other, where they have this hydrogen bonding interaction. So the purple here is going to represent hydrogen bonding. What is hydrogen bonding? Really, it's just a dipole interaction, but it's an extremely strong one that happens when hydrogen is located on an oxygen, nitrogen, or fluorine, because you get such a big dipole. So when water freezes, it happens to form this kind of geometry. And notice how it's hexagonal in geometry. And I'm going to just write this down. This hexagonal arrangement that we have is why snowflakes are six-sided. Snowflakes are six-sided because of the way that water interacts with its own self when it freezes. But when water freezes, what does that mean? We have space that develops between the molecules. That space doesn't exist when we have a liquid, because in a liquid, there's too much energy, and the molecules are moving past each other, so they don't ever lock and stay in this kind of structure. They just collapse. So this space means that it's less dense. Now, those of you really good with your American literature, which I'm not, I just happen to read a few things that I was supposed to, you might know that there's this book where there's the substance Ice Nine that is the core of the book. I think that's the Cat's Cradle, if I'm remembering my text right. And that comes from the fact that, yes, there's not just one structure of ice. There's actually many structures of ice, which the reason I'm flipping through the notes is there was a request that I go back to different pages of notes for people to take their pictures. So I'm just scrolling through as I'm talking here, looking up the phase diagram of ice. And that'll be the last thing I display for us once I'm able to bring the picture up here, which there's a pretty good one. And here, so there, let me just show you the notes really quickly. There's page one, take your screenshots quick. Page two, quick, 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 quick. Page three, page four. And you know what comes next? Page five. And now to end up lecture, let me show you this diagram. So this is the phase diagram of water. You notice where liquid is in the middle there. Vapor down below. To the right, you have this sort of differently shaded area. And that's because water exists there in what is known as a supercritical fluid. So if you look at all those Roman numerals, those represent the different forms of ice that can form. Now, of course, we would all need to Google to see what the difference is, and I don't remember the differences without looking. But just showing you that ice is more complicated stuff than it looks.